Hello, and welcome to another Little Atoms Road Trip podcast. I'm Neil Denny. I'm in Cambridge in Massachusetts, and it's actually the last day of interviews today, and I've just been to the house of the writer Leslie Brunetta. Leslie Brunetta is a freelance writer whose articles have appeared in the New York Times, as well as on NPR and elsewhere. An English graduate of both Princeton and St. Catherine's College, Oxford, she is the co-author of Spider Silk, Evolution and 400 Million Years of Spinning, Waiting, Snagging and Mating, with Catherine L. Craig, who is an internationally recognised evolutionary biologist, arachnologist and authority on silk. I'm sat with Leslie Brunetta. Leslie, thank you for talking to me today.
Thanks for coming back.
So we're going to be talking in the main about your book Spider Silk, which, as the title suggests, is a book about spiders. Why spiders?
Okay, so I'll give you a little backstory so you understand how we sort of came into this. So the full title of the book is Spider Silk, Evolution and 400 Million Years of Spinning, Waiting, Snagging, and Mating. And the way this all happened was I was trying to sell to NPR, which is, you know about NPR, our national public radio. I had done a few commentaries for them. I was trying to sell them this little commentary that I had written that was kind of a joke about human evolution. And it had to do with the fact that, you know, monkeys can't swim. Monkeys can swim, apes can't swim, humans can't swim after they're a certain age when you throw them in the water. It was a little bit of a joke. And they said, well, we like this, but we need you to run it by an evolutionary scientist, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm a freelance writer, so I say, oh, yes, of course, I'll go and run this by an evolutionary scientist, and then, hang up the phone. I'm in a complete panic because I don't know any evolutionary scientists. And it turned out that my husband was working with a guy at Arthur D. Little whose wife was an evolutionary scientist working on spiders, Catherine L. Craig. So she helped me out with this, and it turned out NPR took it anyway. And she asked me if I would just do a little sort of fine polishing on her monograph, which was published by Oxford University Press. So she's Catherine L. Craig. That book was called Spider Webs and Silk. And it's a sort of recap of all of her research as an arachnologist. And she was an experimental arachnologist. She did a lot of evolutionary experiments specifically about the interplay between insect vision and webs. But she is especially interested in the evolution of the silk molecules. So spider silk is actually a protein. And it turns out that, which I didn't know until I was reading her book, it turns out that the orb web weavers, like the Charlotte's web kind, the big sort of wheel webs, those have three or four obvious types of silk. They're completely separate type of silk. They come from different glands. And in her book, she was talking about, you know, how might that have evolved? Because it turns out that if you draw out the evolutionary tree of spiders, and there are, at this point, there are like more than 42,000 known species of spiders, you can actually see, oh, those glands evolved actually quite late in spider evolution. And there are other types of spiders who, you know, not only can't make an orb web, but can't even make that kind of silk. So I'm an English major, right? I have 2 degrees in English literature, but I've always been interested in science. And I grew up in a place where we spent a lot of time outdoors and, you know, we didn't necessarily know what we were looking at or anything like that, but it was always fun and exciting and lots of animals around and lots of bugs. My mother, you know, used to bring us snakes that she would find when she was cutting the lawn and all this kind of stuff. And I'm married to an engineer, so, you know, I'm sort of surrounded by science, and I've always read the Science Times every Tuesday and the New York Times, all this. So I thought, oh yeah, I get evolution. I understand how it works. So at the time I was looking at Kay's book was really the time that a lot of this intelligent design controversy was really starting to bubble up. Mm-hmm. And I was like, you know, how are people falling for this stuff? But I also realized, you know, if I really got into debate with one of those people, I wouldn't be able to debate them. I didn't really know enough about evolution or really understand the real basics of it enough that I would be able to, you know, counter somebody like that. And that started being a little bit scary to me because before the Dover case, it really wasn't clear how far this was going to go. And I didn't think, you know, living in Massachusetts, I didn't think it was really going to kind of come here, but I did have a couple of kids who are going into school. It's a bit scary. So while I was reading Kay's book, I realized that I had these really quite common misconceptions about evolution and about natural selection. One thing was, you know, I didn't really understand what survival of the fittest means. You know, I think, to go back a little bit, about these misconceptions, they really are sort of misconceptions as opposed to false beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of non-biologists have them. They're much more sort of like gut feelings mm-hmm. rather than any kind of firmly held belief, because honestly, most of us have just never spent any time thinking about this stuff. You know, you maybe had a couple of hours about it, if that, in biology class in high school. And then you might read these articles here and there that talk about evolution or talk about discoveries. You never really think really, really hard, like, what's behind all this. So, you know, I didn't really, really understand what survival of the fittest meant. I think I had this kind of, which didn't bear any examination whatsoever, but I think that I had this kind of gut level feeling that evolution, you know, kind of came to pinnacles, that it was mm-hmm. kind of like Wimbledon or the World Cup or something like this, that you would end up with these perfectly adapted mm-hmm. organisms was another problem. I also didn't kind of, I had to go through this kind of like Zen shift, because even though I accepted that it was not directed or anything, it's very hard to let go of the feeling of some kind of purpose or like
direction.
Will to survive. Even if it's not from external, I think mm-hmm. that there's, you know, it's a little Lamarckian in a certain way, this, because we're such agents, or like to believe anyway that we're such kind of agents of our own lives, you kind of feel like, oh, this organism must be kind of willing itself to outcompete the others in order to adapt. Or mm-hmm. somehow, if some catastrophe happens, organisms can somehow will themselves to adapt to the new environment. I think I also had, you know, the big criticism that ID people or creationists have is, you know, you fools, how can you possibly think that everything that you see around you results from completely random? And the thing is, I think that I had this idea that it was just random. I didn't understand that there's a random part of it, but then what happens afterwards is just not random at all. You know, the actual natural selection is not random. And then this whole idea that there's like a balance of nature, that nature is all sort of perfectly balanced as a result of evolution. So while I was going through Kay's book, I realized, first of all, I started realizing just from the example, even though she didn't go into any of that, because she was writing this mainly for other biologists who, this is all second nature to them, all these ideas. I started realizing that these misconceptions I had kept coming up, because if it was the way that I sort of thought it was happening, what she was actually describing couldn't happen. Like, why would there be 40,000 species of spider? There should be like 5 or something, right? And why, for instance, there are these mesothelial spiders that live only in Asia at this point. And they're, you know, clearly their genome has evolved, but visually they're almost perfectly, they're virtually identical to this 290 million year old fossil. And they live in, you know, we don't like to say primitive, but they live in this, they live in burrows. They line the burrows with silk. They can't hang from their silk. They can't make a web. But they're still around, right? So if my previous idea of survival of the fittest held, they shouldn't be around, right? They should have been knocked out by the orb weavers, which we sort of think of as the pinnacle. So anyway, I just realized from this that if the two of us work together, we could come up with a chronology that could go through from the silk genes to the silk proteins, which are, you can just go out in the garden anytime and look at these things, to the organism's behavior and tell a story that would make, you know, all these concepts concrete to non-biologists.
Before we look at how spiders are an excellent test case for looking at evolution, let's just look at spiders for a bit, because the book is also full of amazing information and facts about spiders. So first of all, I'm going to start off with the most basic question imaginable. Yeah. What is a spider?
So a spider is an arachnid. So insects have 6 legs. Arachnids have 8 legs. So spiders have 2 body parts rather than 3 body parts. They have 8 legs. They have chelicerae, which are these, too bad we don't have a visual, they have these sort of, I don't know, tongue kind of things at the front instead of mandibles. They don't have antennas. They don't have wings, which is interesting because they can do all sorts of things without wings. And the other definition of a spider is that they have what are called abdominal spinnerets. So that's these little tubes that are on their abdomens that the silk comes out of. Every spider has abdominal spinnerets, and no other animal has abdominal spinnerets. So if it doesn't have abdominal spinnerets, it's not a spider.
Let's talk about the earliest spiders then. So spider ancestors, where did they come from?
Well, there's very, very good fossil evidence that among the first animals that came onto land were arthropods. So, and some of those very early arthropods are like Harvestmen and Opilionis and Millipedes, I think, are, you know, which are still around, right? So we don't know exactly what the immediate ancestor of the spiders are. I don't know if we'll ever know. It was very clearly an arthropod. It would have been an arachnid or a chelicerate, and there were other arachnids and chelicerates around at the time. And there is this fossil that's, I think, 390 million years old of this creature that's known as Atercopus. I can never pronounce it, Fimbriunguis or something, but it's Atercopus. And that was found a few decades ago in upstate New York. And when they first were examining it, they thought that that was the first spider. They thought, not the first spider, but they thought that was the oldest spider fossil that they had yet found. And its legs, everything about its legs looked like a spider. And they thought they found a spinneret, which was why they said that it was a spider. Just in the last few years, it was re-examined. Paul Selden and colleagues re-examined it. And what they figured out was that the thing that they thought was a spinneret was actually a plate from the abdomen that had been kind of folded over. But it did have what definitely looked like silk spigots on it. And there's even thing that's like a filament of silk. And they found some other fossils of this. So it seems it's hard to believe that that's not either an ancestor of the spiders, or at the very least, it's very closely related to the ancestor of the spiders.
You talk in the book about a species of spider or a family of spider that can be described as a living fossil, one that's mm-hmm. basically been unchanged for millions of years. So mm-hmm. tell us about that. Do you notice how I didn't have attempt to pronounce it?
Yeah, well, I should say that I have a feeling I pronounce a lot of these arachnology or arachnology, whatever, terms. I have a feeling I mispronounce a lot of them. But so these... This is a suborder of spiders called a mesothelae. And nowadays, so the oldest mesothelae fossil is about 290 million years old. And nowadays, they only live in, or at least they've only been found in Southeast Asia. It's really too bad because they're under threat mainly by subsistence farmers. And the reason being that they live in burrows. So when you think of what the world was like during the evolution of these spiders, they were not insects flying around. If there were any insects flying around, there were very, very few insects flying around. Plants were very, very small, so there wasn't a lot of shade. But there were lots of predators around, including lots of other arthropods. I mean, it's not like they were necessarily big predators, but there were lots and lots of small predators running around. So the way that these mesotheles still live is they dig a burrow, they line it with silk, they make a trap door by binding together the silk and dirt and stuff from around. And then they, during the day, when the sun would have been, you know, really beating down on them, they just stay closed up in the burrow. And then when it starts to get dark, they flip open the door and they kind of wait there. And when they feel the vibration of prey coming by, they lunge through, grab the prey, and bring it back in. Now, unfortunately, not a whole lot of research has been done on their silk, because most of the research has been done on the silk that we would like to do something mm-hmm. with in an industrial sense. They make, it's almost certainly, you know, a few different silk proteins, but they use it all interchangeably. And they just use it for lining their burrow. There are some of them make these little sort of trip lines radiating out from the burrow. So when something goes by, it trips it and they feel that vibration. And they also use it during spider sex, which is kind of a strange thing. The males make what's called a sperm web, and they deposit their sperm on the silk, and then at the end of, they have these little limbs at the front called pedipalps, and there are these bulbs at the end that they draw the sperm up into that, and that's how they mate. So they don't do any of the things that most of us think spiders mm-hmm. do with silk.
Let's bring in the silk and the web then, because this is one of the, you know, the most remarkable features of a spider. So do we know when
they first started to appear, when spiders first started to make webs in the, yeah, I guess in the funnel web.
Yeah,
sorry,
the ones that the orb web. Yeah,
in the sort of orb web.
Seen all the photos all the time. Yeah. So for most of us, that's the web that we think of, right? But first of all, not all spiders make webs. Mm-hmm. Like, for instance, there are 5,000 species of jumping spider. I think there's only one species that we know of that makes a web. And then even of the webs, a minority of them are the orb webs. Mm-hmm. So this is what we trace out in the book. So you have the mesotheles who are living in burrows. They share a common ancestor with the megalomorphs, which includes the tarantulas, and then the araneomorphs, which includes, you know, most of the familiar web spinners.
They're described as the true spiders.
True spiders, because they're the most spidery.
Yeah.
So that's the other thing that's very interesting about sort of thinking about evolution, is you realize how much of what we, especially before we got to some of this genetic stuff, you realize that how much of what's been discovered is partly sort of colored by how we define things, mm-hmm. not necessarily the way things are.
Yeah.
I think we're getting much, much closer now to the way that things really... So the megalomorphs, which have the tarantulas and a whole bunch of other spiders, there are like 3,000 different megalomorph species. Some of them live pretty much like the mesotheles, where they just live in burrows and line their burrows. I shouldn't say just, because it's actually a pretty amazing way to live. But there are some of them who make sheet webs. So they're just like these sheets of silk that they lay out from their burrows. There are some that make funnel webs, which are sheets that are sort of in a funnel shape that lead into their hiding place. So that's kind of the beginnings of webs, if you think about threads of silk being mm-hmm. put together. Evolving at the same time, but kind of in a different direction from them, are the araneomorphs. And the thing that sets the araneomorphs apart from the megalomorph, the tarantulas and all of them, and the mesotheles, is that they can make this silk called major ampullate silk, which is the silk that you see spiders hanging from. Mm-hmm. So nobody knows exactly why spiders first started making silk, except that there are a lot of other arthropods who make silk for all sorts of reasons. I mean, silkworms, obviously, but there are all sorts of other creatures who make silk. Maybe spiders first started using it to lay a trail to find their way back to their burrow. Maybe it had something to do with reproduction. You know, we don't really know. But you can see it start gaining strength. And we explain in the book genetically how you can see these little changes that actually make pretty big differences mm-hmm. in the proteins. But you can imagine that if you can start making a silk that's strong enough for you to hang on, that's really great, because probably the first thing that was used for was probably not to make webs, but to escape from mm-hmm. your predators. You can just like drop out of danger on this thing. But at the same time, as a kind of parallel benefit, it also starts allowing you to move around in the environment in a way that would be pretty dangerous for a megalomorph, for instance. Mm-hmm. So they can start to do all sorts of things with this silk before they ever start making the orb web. So the orb web makers are a small piece of the larger araneomorph tree. And so we trace through the various kind of webs that are made, that evolved earlier using major ampullate silk. Then you eventually get into a phase of spiders where they're actually making horizontal orb webs, which makes sense, especially when you think of insect responses to light. Mm-hmm. A lot of them will fly up towards light or down into darkness. So these horizontal orb weavers will often span like a, let's say, the stump of a tree, you know, where there's a hollow in the stump of a tree or something. So then the insects underneath hatch or wake up and fly up and they're caught in the web. And that has a particular kind of silk on it that is not sticky like glue, but works by van der Waals forces. And then you get this other, they share a common ancestor with the vertical orb weavers. So that's the one we're always talking about. And there are a few things that are different about the vertical orb weavers. One is they're hanging them vertically. Two is they have what we call a death spiral, the capture spiral that goes around, which is the sticky, actual mm-hmm. sticky part of the web. The other parts are not sticky. That's a new kind of silk. The glue on it is a new kind of protein glue, and probably as a byproduct, although there's probably some selection factor going on in there, the optical qualities of the silk is a bit different, of the spiral silk is mm-hmm. a bit different, so that it's translucent. So there are funny things that happen between the way insects see things and the way the spider appears, spider web appears to them. But the main thing about major ampullate silk is it kind of frees you from the burrow or hiding mm-hmm. lifestyle.
I want to start to bring the evolution in as we're talking through these things. You've been talking there about the numerous different types of silk, and that was something that was new to me from the book, that there are typical web will contain numerous types of silk. So let's talk about perhaps how we can sort of trace the path of evolution through those various different silks.
So there's been, what's great is because of the kind of genetic research, genetic and protein research that people have been able to do over the last 20 years, and now it's even getting better because it's getting cheaper to do this, and the fact that you've got this fossil record, you can start putting these two things together. So the thing that I think is really cool about the evolution of spiders is, you know, for instance, if you think about any animal that you choose, any animal, any plant, any whatever, if you dig into it, it's an excellent case study for evolution, mm-hmm. right? Because that's evolution. It's everything. The thing that's really cool about spiders is it's very hard to, you know, you wouldn't be able to sort of isolate one gene that results in a bird's, you know, a hawk's wing, uh-huh. for instance. It's a whole complex of genes. But with spiders, what's so cool is they put this stuff out into the external world. So you can do all sorts of tests on it. But it's just a protein. So it allows you to go very directly back to the gene that's scripting it. And now that they've characterized more of these proteins and more of these genes, what they've found is you can really draw out a family tree, not just of the spiders, but a family tree of the silks. And it turns out that the systematics of the silks very closely match the systematics of the spiders and the kind of fossil record. So, you know, if you look at, I think only recently, and I haven't actually seen this paper yet, but only very recently has somebody characterized mesothelial silk. But I can guarantee you what you'll find is that it's a very, what we would call like a disorganized protein. There's not much repetition in the amino acids in it, so you don't get much interlocking in it. So it serves the purposes of that spider very well, but it's not very strong, okay? What you can see as you kind of go through the evolution of these different proteins is you see some of them going to where the kind of repetition that happens in the amino acids allows the protein molecule to lock up in such a way that it's like a very, very strong chain. You see, so that's, for instance, the major ampullate silk that yeah. they hang off of. That's the one that people have done the most research on because they want to make it.
That particular silk is always described as being, you know, incredibly strong, one yeah. of the strongest things in nature. Of course, if there was one hanging here, I could break it, no problem. So why do we describe it as strong then? You've already, I guess, started explaining
it's,
that.
I think it, what's the right term, like weight for weight? Mm-hmm. If you had a filament that fine of steel, the spider silk would be stronger. And then it has other advantages. The reason that they would really like to know why spiders make this stuff is, first of all, just the properties of it, that mm-hmm. it's so strong. Second of all, it's biodegradable. Right. So like, for instance, if you could make fishing nets out of this stuff and then you lose your fishing net, instead of creatures forever getting, sea animals forever getting caught up in it, it would actually over time degrade. And the other thing is, you know, when we make, you know, at a foundry, or I don't think it's called a foundry for steel, but, you know, the steel factory looks mm-hmm. like, right, the flame shooting and the welder's masks and all of this stuff. And, you know, a spider just does it at room temperature and atmospheric pressure. So just from eating dead bugs. So people would love to know how to do that. And there's been progress towards it. It's still, as far as I know, nobody's really there yet in terms of being able to produce mass quantities of it. Part of that is just because proteins are just so, so complicated. And it's also not clear. It's very clear that the genes itself largely determine what happens. But then the other thing that's hard to kind of figure out is what happens to that protein as it's coming through this tiny, tiny duct from the gland out through the spinneret. There are chemical changes that happen mm-hmm. in there. There are also pressure changes. Then there's tension. Like, all of that goes towards making it the way that it is, and that's pretty hard to replicate.
Another aspect of the spiders that I'd like to look at through the sort of prism of evolution is their eyes. Tell us about the eyes of a spider.
I'm not much of an expert on the eyes of the spider. I've really, really focused in on the silk, but I can tell you a few basic things about their eyes. One is they don't have complex eyes like insects. They have camera eyes. So, and also they have anywhere, depending on, you can actually tell which I don't know at what level, I don't know if it's at the family or the genus or whatever, but you can tell where in the family tree they are by how many eyes they have. There are very few, I think, that have two eyes. I think those are usually living caves where they don't rely on their sight much. And then there are some that have six eyes and some that have eight eyes. And by our standards, I suppose you would say that their eyes are kind of simple, but they do fine for them. I mean, they've got them. They've got the eyes on a single spider will be of different sizes, mm-hmm. and they're kind of arrayed around so that they can see out at different angles. And then the most remarkable ones are jumping spiders. So jumping spiders, I mean, the whole reason they can have their whole lifestyle is because they produce this major ampullate silk. So like if they jump and they miss, it's okay because they're just on a like a bungee cord. But they have two really big, almost sort of headlight eyes out in front that apparently are quite acute. I just saw that Ed Young just had a report on his blog about some research that Robert Jackson and his colleagues have done about this one species of jumping spider that prefers mosquitoes that have recently fed on blood, and that these jumping spiders can actually tell the difference between, for instance, male and female antenna on these mosquitoes. I mean, it's pretty amazing.
And that's with their eyes.
Yeah. You know, and then obviously there's a whole processing system behind that, and that's what's all very interesting.
Another great thing about this book would be if it made people a bit more welcoming to spiders. A lot of people are not particularly keen on spiders, and I'd perhaps like to look a little bit about what sort of spiders are actually dangerous to humans.
Not very many. Like, particularly in England, I don't think that you have any.
No, I don't think we do.
I don't think you have any. And it is interesting because, in general, I find that English people are a lot more friendly towards spiders than Americans are towards spiders. And, you know, maybe that's because we have black widows and we have tarantulas and stuff. But I don't know if you saw this, there was just a scare. There was a story floating around India that this village, it sounded like a pack of tarantulas came running out and attacked these villagers, and two of them died, and, you know, it's all turned out not to be true. And historically, if you look at deaths from spider, they're very, very rare. Even in Australia, where they actually do have some really dangerous spiders, they're relatively... I mean, if you're the person who gets bitten, it's not relative. They have very few bites per year. They have anti-venom now, so it's very rare that somebody would die of a bite from a spider. And in general, spiders are not going to come after you. The problem is if you, like, put your hand into a wood pile, or let's say you have a pair of boots that you haven't used for a long time, you stick your foot in without shaking it out first. Because really, they're only going to bite you in the worst case for them, because really what they would prefer to do is get out of the way. And it turns out that also most bites, you know, people go to hospitals with spider bites. They've hardly ever seen the spider that's bitten them. And what they're realizing now is that most of these things are some other kind of insect bite or very small puncture wound that gets infected with antibiotic-resistant bacteria. That's really what's going on for most of these things.
So the lesson is, be nicer to spiders.
Yeah, and they catch, you can see a fair amount of silk around this room. they catch huge amounts of insects.
So I've been talking about spiders and about her book, Spider Silk, to Leslie Brunetta. Leslie, thank you for talking to Little Atoms today.
Thank you very much.
I'm Delene Beeland. That was a Little Atoms Road Trip podcast. The show was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was made possible by a traveling fellowship from the Winston Churchill Memorial Trust. Follow the trip on Twitter @LittleAtoms, and thanks for listening.